Support comes from Smart Columbus, presenting Pivot, Central Ohio's free navigation app that is locally designed to help you get around the region using COTA, taxis, scooters, and more. Plan, book, and pay for your trips. It's simple. Download Pivot on Google Play or the App Store today.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. State lawmakers are mulling a bill that would limit the governor's authority to declare states of emergency and to issue public health orders. The measure would set expiration dates for such orders and extend more oversight powers to the legislature. DeWine last week pushed back. He cited decreasing rates of COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations in Ohio due to his curfew and masking orders during the pandemic.
Some of the same critics, some of my friends, didn't want us to require masks in school. They said people won't wear, kids won't wear masks, parents will rebel, it's not necessary. And we said K through 12, and then people really went crazy. What we've learned is that that has worked exceedingly well. And it's enabled many, many of our kids to be in school virtually the entire year with very, very little spread in the classroom.
It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Jesse Balmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
And Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Jeremy.
And good to be here.
And Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Karen.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
So it's Republicans versus Republicans, again, same old story. The bill's known as Senate Bill 22. It's different from previous attempts to, sit on the governor and his pandemic orders. How so? Karen, I'm sorry.
It's sponsored by one of the two sponsors whose bill was vetoed by Governor DeWine last time around. It's again a continuing attempt to try to, like you said, sit on the governor and kind of, as sponsors will say, add in a legislative role in these executive orders and in these public health orders. I should say public health orders, not executive orders. And what this one tries to do is to just get it. First, it was going to be a committee of lawmakers. Now it's going to be the Ohio House and Senate that would weigh in on these orders and would potentially have the ability to cancel them, would limit states of emergency to, I think it's 90 days, maybe 60 days. I can't remember.
I think it's 90,
the specifics.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, they say that this is not unusual, that other states are doing this too, that other states have limits on states of emergency. For instance, we've been under a state of emergency in Ohio since last March, and other states have limits on how long you can be in the state of emergency situation. And so they want to institute that. They want lawmakers to have a role here. But of course, the question is, if you're trying to do something with public health and you're trying to do it quickly, how do you bring state lawmakers in? How do you bring in 132 state lawmakers who want to get together, have committees and debate and all this stuff? And it just makes it really difficult to move quickly.
And most of whom are not public health experts. I mean, it does seem like, Jeremy Pelzer, it's an executive sort of a job. That's what we need, you know, different arms of government, different branches of government for, is the executive's good at some things like turning on a dime, whereas the Ohio General Assembly has proved repeatedly it is not.
Sure. Lawmakers' response to that would be that there are checks and balances that are needed to make sure that the governor both has the ability to respond, but then also doesn't have unfettered ability to do whatever he wants. And in this case, lawmakers clearly disagree with DeWine and think that he has gone too far in a lot of these things, such as businesses, closing businesses and issuing stay-at-home orders, mask mandates. They don't like any of that. And they want to be able to stop that, frankly. That's what this is about. Frankly, if they agreed with DeWine on all this, they wouldn't be trying to do this.
Right, right. Jesse Balmer, the governor, do you think he'll veto it again?
Well, DeWine had interesting responses to this last week, because on Tuesday he said he would veto this, as he has any other sort of restriction on his powers as as governor and his administration's ability to institute these health orders, which he and other health experts who he's brought in have said, you know, save lives, allow them to act quickly. Probably your listeners will remember both Senate Bill 55, which would have taken the teeth out of the health orders, and then more prominently Senate Bill 311, which restricted the orders or ability to quarantine someone who had perhaps not been exposed, or there was no evidence of them being directly exposed. Both of those were vetoed last year. So on Tuesday he said, I'll veto it just like these other ones. Then asked about it on Thursday, he said, well, we like some of the changes they've made. We're willing to work with them. I wouldn't sign this current version, but maybe we can get to something that we can all agree on. And part of that is the politics of it. The Senate passed this with enough votes that they could override a veto. Okay. But I think a lot, both DeWine and the lawmakers would like to put this issue behind them a little bit. It has dominated so much of the legislative process.
Yeah, Karen Kassler?
Yeah, and DeWine's point has been that it's not just about him, though. Absolutely. If state lawmakers agreed with everything he was doing, this wouldn't be happening. But he says that he's worried about the long-term effects, that, you know, now that we're starting to potentially be closer to the end of the pandemic than the beginning of it, that this may not be something that would affect him directly. But he says he's worried about other governors and future state health directors who may be trying to deal with, you know, not just a pandemic, but other potential problems and catastrophes. I mean, you start thinking about weather events and things like this, you know, he says he's worried about that being the long-term impact of this, that if you're just trying to do something for the pandemic, and it makes a change all the way down the road, what does that do over time? And so that's where he says his concern is. But again, the point is, if state lawmakers were agreeing with everything he was doing, then this would not be a discussion that would be happening.
Well, I mean, you wouldn't even know they're from the same party anymore, not because of any kind of ideological differences, but just in terms of what they agree on, which it seems to be very little these days. There is some question as to whether the bill is constitutional. Can any of you talk about that? Jeremy?
Sure. There was this LSC, Legislative Service Commission memo, saying that it's referencing this old 1912 Ohio Supreme Court case in which the legislature passed a resolution conveying some land. And so critics are saying, well, the Supreme Court ruled that you can't pass a law via a resolution. And the Supreme Court ruling proves it. And so supporters of Senate Bill 22, opponents of DeWine, say, well, that's about land. This isn't about land.
So this is Senate Bill 22 is a resolution?
So the whole idea was that would be that the House and the Senate would pass a concurrent resolution or a joint resolution, excuse me.
Okay.
To overrule the governor's orders here. That's how, that's under the bill, how it would work. They would pass a resolution. And so the critics are saying, well, the Supreme Court says you can't do it by resolution. And so that's up in the air. And frankly, if this passes, I expect the Ohio Supreme Court might have to weigh in on that again.
Okay. All right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Jeremy Pelzer. He's politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Also with us, Jesse Balmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. The statewide COVID-19 vaccine portal that was supposed to be up and running as early as Valentine's Day, we were talking about it a couple weeks ago. It's not going to be ready for weeks. Jesse Balmert, what's the holdup? Because I did an entire show on the struggle of the getting your vaccine and figuring out how to do it.
Yeah, I think the DeWine administration now is saying, oh, we had this internal deadline that we wanted to have it up, but not like accessible to the average Ohioan by Valentine's Day, which is really not anyone's normal understanding of we're going to have this ready by Valentine's Day. So the current situation is they're trying to get providers on board. So people who give out the vaccines, whether that be pharmacies, whether that be health departments, and some of these entities have their own scheduling system, and they want to make sure that doesn't conflict with the state's scheduling system. And especially if a local pharmacy has a waiting list, they don't want to screw up that waiting list by putting it on this statewide database. So they're saying it'll be another, 2 to 3 weeks to get that rolling. But meanwhile, you have people who are trying to schedule a vaccine, who are facing a lot of troubles, who are trying to make phone calls, who are waiting days to make this happen. It's not a user-friendly process for most Ohioans.
I just wonder, at what point is everything going to just have to come to a standstill so they can reset, or what? Karen Kessler?
Well, I think part of the problem is, when we started out where it was people over 80, and then people over 75, people over 70, when you start adding all these people in there to the people who are still in the first group, the first responders and the healthcare workers, who they're still catching up with some of those people who were hired in, who are on leave, who do have to be vaccinated. Then you've got all the school workers, the teachers that are coming in. You have a huge population of people, 2.2 million people in this 1B group alone. You're getting about 140,000 vaccines a week. You start doing the math, and as more and more people come into the system, but the supply has not increase dramatically, then the virus, the vaccine is getting a little bit scarce. And I think it's been really difficult for people who are not particularly computer savvy, or are working on behalf of those who are not, and they're trying to chase down, where can I get the vaccine? How far away do I have to travel? Some counties do have it available, some counties don't. And I think the idea of having some sort of a central clearinghouse, especially ready before the group opens up again, and you get more people, like people over 50, and then that's going to add a whole new group of people, millions more Ohioans into that available, that age eligible group. You want to have something set up, I think, by then, to make it a little bit easier, because otherwise it's really going to get, like you said, kind of out of control.
Yeah, and there's uncertainty, Jeremy, about who's going to get the vaccine next, and that kind of a thing. They seem to be, it just seems to be a free-for-all at this point, kind of, depending on if you can fall into another category. Police officers, preschool teachers, and childcare workers are still waiting. How have they explained the logic of how they're doing things?
They're focusing on the logic of people they are including than people they're not including. They haven't gone into a lot of detail of here's why we're leaving people out. They're saying, well, they'll be soon, but they're focusing more on here's why we're including teachers, here's why we're including healthcare workers and so forth. It's from the beginning, it's been sort of a very kind of ad hoc, we're done with 1A. Okay, who's in 1B now? Let's turn the page and kind of go like that, as opposed to having a lengthy, all the way down to, the gift shop workers of the world, or whoever, that they have a comprehensive plan about who's going to get it and in what order they're going to get it.
And, Jesse, the problem for so many people is the most vulnerable are the ones that need it the most and have the biggest challenges in getting it.
Yeah. And to your point about people not knowing who is next, this stands in contrast to what other states are doing. For example, if you lived in Kentucky, you could go onto the state's website, answer a few questions, and find out exactly which group you're in. And maybe not when exactly you're going to get the vaccine, but you know where you stand in line. And so what DeWine has said is they're trying to prioritize which vaccines will save the most lives. And the logic behind an age-based approach is the vast majority of the deaths, the vast majority of the serious consequences from COVID-19 have come from older Ohioans. And so age has been their main way of approaching this. And I think there's some frustration among people who are younger and might have conditions that put them at serious risk of COVID complications. For example, cancer patients, people with kidney disease, COPD, are all listed on the CDC's list of having high risk of severe consequences from this, but none of those are on Ohio's list of people getting the COVID vaccine right now, and those people don't know where they stand on their list.
And how does Governor DeWine explain that?
So I talked with Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff about this, and the way they approached it, which is unique, this is not the way most states are doing it, is they prioritize conditions that started in either birth or childhood and then continued into adulthood. And so that's why you see type 1 diabetes, typically known as juvenile diabetes, on Ohio's list, but you don't see type 2 diabetes, which is also proven to have, you know, severe consequences. It's interesting, most states have type 2, but have excluded type 1. So we're even different there. And so I think that causes some frustration for people who saw that they were on this CDC list of being high risk and even listed on Ohio Department of Health, you know, information as being high risk. And then they look at the list and it doesn't reflect that.
So is there anywhere anyone can go to get sort of a clearinghouse on, to see a clearinghouse on what are the best options for getting a vaccine? You know, what's the best pharmacy? What's the best wherever? No, nothing.
Yeah, I mean, the state's website has a list, which initially didn't have a map. So Cincinnati Inquirer and other publications created a map. The State Department of Health has since created a map of where these locations are, where you can obtain a vaccine. And so you can go on there and look at the list of where it might be close to you, but then you just have to start the process of calling to see whether there's a vaccine available, whether you can get an appointment. And even last week, we ran into problems where the snowstorms and the weather delayed some of the vaccines arriving in Ohio, or maybe delayed just the ability of people to get to them. So there's a lot of factors in play.
You know, I wonder if there's any sense from anyone you're talking to that having a change at the top in Washington is creating a little bit more stability, is changing the tenor of all of this at all. What do you think, Jeremy Pelzer?
To be honest, I haven't really been following that. Maybe my colleagues can weigh in on that.
Yeah. Karen Kassler?
Well, I know DeWine has been really careful about, he was very careful about criticizing the Trump administration. And obviously he was in a difficult position in the sense that Trump had a way of punishing people who would criticize him. Yeah. And so I think DeWine was very cautious about doing that. And then right after the administration change, when the Biden administration came in, DeWine wrote a letter to him saying, here's how we can improve this whole process. So I think he hasn't had a lot of praise for the DeWine administration, for the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. But I think that he's had a lot of communication that he hasn't necessarily talked about. And certainly when you hear the Biden administration talking about 600 million doses will be available by the end of the summer, you know, these are good news kinds of things. But of course, we're still trying to catch up to what happened just in the last week. And I saw some vaccine clinics that were canceled because of the bad weather and because of shipments that didn't arrive. It's going to be the next week or so, I think, is going to be really kind of catching up to all that as people are still trying to come into the system.
We will return to our weekly reporter roundtable, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Smart Columbus, presenting Pivot, Central Ohio's free navigation app that is locally designed to help you get around the region using Coda, taxis, scooters, and more. Plan, book, and pay for your trips. It's simple. Download Pivot on Google Play or the App Store today.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us? Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Cincinnati Inquirer, State Government Reporter Jesse Balmert, and Cleveland.com Politics Reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Okay, the First Energy Corp the Akron utility under investigation over that $61 million bribery scandal involving former Speaker of the House, Larry Householder. Well, First Energy took steps last week to improve its public image. What was that announcement, Jeremy Pelzer?
Well, they did a couple of things. First of all, they announced that they're going to be just more transparent. Actually, they released something just this morning saying they reached a deal with the New York Pension Fund to release for the next 3 years publicly just a whole bunch of political spending, all of its political spending to candidates, to political committees, to groups that have a political agenda, and just kind of open their books to the public on their website. And that's going above and beyond what they have been required to disclose. In addition, as you say, last week, they also said that they released some more details. It's not completely clear, but they said that they have been collecting money from ratepayers for a purpose that was that they suggested was improper. They haven't gone into too many more details about exactly what that means, but they're, you get the idea generally that the new leadership, because the old leadership at First Energy, the one that oversaw what that was in place during the House Bill 6 scandal, mm-hmm. they mostly left. And now this new group of leaders is coming in and they're trying to clean house a little bit. It might be a little incremental, but they seem to be trying to rehabilitate their image.
So they're going to be more transparent, but they're also going to change some behavior as far as political spending, right?
Correct. Yeah, okay. They're trying to basically just
get out of the business of political spending.
They're trying to get out of the hole that they dug themselves in House Bill 6. And of course, the other shoe that might drop is it remains to be seen if any First Energy executives or the company might be charged uh-huh. under this federal House Bill 6 investigation. There's also the question of this shady $4 million payment to the former head of the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, Sam Rinaldo. It remains to be seen what that's all about. If there's going to be any indictments or anything action taken about that as well. So there's a lot going on.
Yeah. Well, we wait for this other half of the equation to kind of flesh out, you know, on the First Energy side. Jesse Balmert, what about the connection to dark money groups? That's really where a lot of the money went, right?
Yeah, that was another thing that First Energy talked about in their conversations with their stockholders and so forth last week, was they're going to get out of the dark money game, which was so much a part of this federal investigation. The allegations are that Company A, which everyone believes to be First Energy, donated nearly $61 million. And First Energy's kind of affiliated companies and a few other energy companies donated this money through a variety of dark money groups. For example, some of it went to Partners for Progress, which was a dark money group, then went to Generation Now, which was another dark money group, which was then sent to for-profit corporations, which don't need to disclose their donors, and to PACs, which, you know, kind of shielded the original location of the money. So some portion of this is legal. Like, you are allowed, corporations are allowed to donate money to groups that don't need to disclose their donors, but where the federal investigators say this became problematic was the level of coordination with the people who were involved, also some of where that money was spent. For example, there's an allegation that some of the money went to repair Larry Householder's Florida home. So, you know, there's a lot of ways you can move money around legally under the current system without disclosing hardly anything. But this was a way that I got caught up in it somewhat illegally, or at least that's what.
Well, the fact that you don't have to disclose lends itself to a lot of monkey business, Karen Kassler, right? That's the whole problem with the dark money scenario.
Yeah, but it also shows what the system really tolerates and what, like, I mean, as Jesse was saying, this stuff was not illegal. And right. So I think, you know, people who have been shocked and horrified by this might not realize that this is what the system has been allowing to happen. And so now The question is, where do you go with it? I mean, there's still debate over what do you do with House Bill 6? Do you repeal it entirely? I mean, the Senate last week took some steps to repeal some parts of House Bill 6, but do you repeal the entire thing because it does so much? And then also, what do you do about Larry Householder in particular? Once again, a situation where he was reelected to his seat. He is still there in the legislature. And I'll tell you, Speaker Bob Cupp is really not happy about taking continued questions from reporters about why he's still there. Cupp has been saying over and over that he's talking to members of the Republican caucus about what to do about Larry Householder, but nothing has been done. And that certainly suggests that there's still some power that Householder holds. And it does show just how this system, while it seems shocking that these things happened, this is how it works.
And just to be clear, I mean, this is the outcome or an example of many, there's others, of the Supreme Court decision that these are, they don't have to disclose these kind, their spending or their, well, not so much their spending, but is, they don't just disclose where their contributions come from in these dark money groups. And that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. So, the question is, how do you write that? Nothing's really going to change, right, Jesse?
Well, here's what other states have done that Ohio hasn't done. You can have these donations, but you can have more disclosure and more transparency. There's nothing that prevents Ohio lawmakers from passing a law saying, we need to know the top three donors of each dark money group. Like, for example, this is a law in another state where if someone runs an ad that says, you know, paid for by the Unicorns and Puppies, you know, Incorporated, then after Unicorns and Puppies, they list, you know, First Energy, AUP, Exelon, or something like that. The top three donors have to be disclosed. So this is something Ohio could do. It's something that current Lieutenant Governor John Husted pushed for years ago, but it is not something that has passed. It, frankly, the current system benefits both Republicans and Democrats, and those are the people who would have to make a change.
Hmm. So what do you think, Jeremy Pelzer, any chance?
I think Jesse's absolutely right. Hmm. The people who benefit from the current system are the people who are currently in office, and they have no incentive to change the system that got them to where they are right now. And I don't see any movement at all to improve political disclosure in Ohio.
Hmm. Karen Kassler?
That's actually the same kind of a situation with gerrymandering, too.
Yeah.
In that the people who are in the system, they don't benefit from a change. So that's one reason why these groups actually took that to voters and said, we want to change the process by which the congressional districts are drawn and also the state house districts are drawn. That's supposed to happen after we finally get the census results, whenever that is going to happen. But yeah, it does show that people who are in the system who are benefiting from it, there's not a whole lot of incentive to change it.
So is there any, I mean, we've talked about gerrymandering, and we know that there's this new process coming forward because from outside, it came from outside groups, good government groups and that kind of a thing. Any sense that anybody's got willing or has the resources to do a statewide issue on dark money groups? Karen?
Well, I know that Common Cause Ohio, which is one of the big forces with the gerrymandering,
right,
they've talked about this for years.
Yeah.
The question is, how do you put it before voters and make it so that they approve it, that they want to do this? And I don't know that necessarily, I haven't heard that they're working on this yet, but certainly they've talked about it for a very long time.
Hmm. Anybody else?
There was a bill that was introduced last General Assembly, which I think will be reintroduced from Representative Gail Manning and Jessica Miranda, a Republican and a Democrat, that Frank LaRose, the Secretary of State, got involved in. So I think there was at least some interest immediately after the scandal broke. And if this scandal does have legs and continues, I think that puts pressure on lawmakers to do something. But if this kind of ends with five individuals, then maybe not.
Speaking of Secretary of State Frank LaRose, I mean, he's now issued the order that they will again, limit the number of ballot boxes to one per county, not ballot, but where you can drop your ballot in. Yeah.
Drop boxes.
Yeah. Drop boxes. Thank you. To one per county again. That was something that he sounded like he would support expanding the number, but he just said that there just wasn't enough time during the fall election to get that done. Now we have, Jeremy, a primary coming up in May. There's still not enough time?
Well, his LaRosa's argument at the time was, hey, I would love to have more than one drop box per county if it was up to me, but it's not up to me. It's up to the legislature, and the legislature hasn't done anything, so my hands are tied. And I suspect that's the same argument here. Yeah, he said there's also not enough time, but he also said, well, it's up to lawmakers, not up to me.
And is that absolutely clear, or is that just his opinion?
Well, it hasn't been litigated, but okay. That's his opinion.
Yeah, Jesse?
Yeah, actually, several court cases went through, and they said that he could do this if he wanted to. Like, Ohio law doesn't require him to make a decision about the drop boxes, but it also doesn't say you can't make a decision about the drop boxes. And so it was in his purview to make that decision if he wanted to. I think you maybe look to Frank LaRosa's background as a state lawmaker, as a senator who kind of values that legislative process and maybe more people weighing in on it. So I think that's more about his background than his ability to do that.
Karen Kassler, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jesse's onto something there, because I mean, I think Frank LaRosa is somebody who's probably looking for the next opportunity to run for another office. And so I think, you know, there's a political element in what's happening here. And certainly he and the Democrats have gone back and forth over this whole Dropbox situation. He had said that, yeah, he wanted to add them, but he didn't feel that he had the authority. There wasn't enough time. And then former Ohio Democratic Party Chair David Pepper and others came back after him saying, hey, you can do this. And I think this whole thing, I think what LaRosa would like to see is state lawmakers just settle it once and for all.
Well, everyone would like to see state lawmakers do a whole bunch of stuff, you know, that they just don't do.
Right. And I think, you know, that's something that you're seeing in other states too, is that state lawmakers are picking up certain deals with voting that come from the 2020 election, you know, cracking down on what they claim is voter fraud, which, as we've said over and over, there's no significant voter fraud in the system. Fortunately, Ohio has not yet seen any sort of legislation that would limit our early voting or impose photo ID on voters and things like that. But, you know, this is one of those pieces of legislation that potentially could clear it up once and for all. But, you know, I'm thinking back to the campaign, and I can remember there was a court decision that allowed for drop boxes to be added in Cuyahoga County. And then there was all this confusion about whether that could be applied to the entire state. And it is frustrating for some voter advocates to see drop boxes so prominent in other states, like in Michigan. But then we only have one per county in Ohio, and it's not necessarily the one that's the most centrally located or easiest to get to.
I will say, like, not in defense of any policy position whatsoever, there will be significantly fewer voters in this primary than there were trying to vote in the general election. And so those lines and, you know, the inconvenience of the drop box, I imagine, will be lessened.
Right. Yeah. But the principle remains. And I mean, the idea that if you want to encourage the kind of turnout that there was in 2020 and 2018, even, you know, it seems like it's something. And again, it's something Frank LaRosa wants to do. Why doesn't he do it? That's what the good government folks would say. Let's continue our conversation. There's so much to talk about. We've got to get to the U.S. Senate race. I also am curious about the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. And speaking of Sam Randazzo resigning from his chairmanship of that commission, a la House Bill 6, that to talk about, and heaven knows what else. So stay with us. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. Just heard Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Also with us, Karen Kassler, the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Cincinnati Inquirer, state government reporter Jesse Bulmert, Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer, and bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Karen Kassler. Just to quickly get at the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, I guess a former state appeals judge, Dennis Dieters, has been appointed to a full term on the commission, but do they have a chairman yet? Jeremy Pelzer, what's the deal?
They do not have a chairman yet. And on Friday, Governor DeWine reappointed Dieters. He's a Republican, and he is the brother of former state treasurer and Hamilton County prosecutor Joe Dieters.
Yeah.
Dennis Dieters was reappointed to another 5-year term. And then, meanwhile, you have Randazzo's seat, which is still open. And the latest on that is this nominating council, this nominating committee, which by law submits 4 names to the governor, and then the governor picks among those 4. They submitted 4 new names to him, and he's going to have to pick among those. The committee previously sent 4 names to him, and he rejected all of them, so they just sent 4 new names. So just to be clear, because it's the PUCO, so of course it's complicated. Once they pick someone to fill Randazzo's seat, that doesn't necessarily mean they'll be chair. They could pick anyone to be chair, although it's probably likely that whoever they appoint will become the next chair.
Oh, okay.
It's not guaranteed.
All right. Okay, so former Ohio Republican Party leader, most recently, I mean, just a few weeks ago, Jane Timken resigned from her post at the Ohio Republican Party. She last week announced her run for the U.S. Senate. That's no big surprise, right, Jesse Bulmert?
Correct. I think after she resigned from the Ohio Republican Party post, a lot of people assumed she was going to be running for U.S. Senate. She also hired some prominent political operatives, including Corey Bliss, who ran Rob Portman's campaign the last time around. So she was making movements like she was going to run for this office and then ultimately decided to do so last week. And that sets up a primary on the Republican side with former Treasurer Josh Mandel, and then maybe some other people will get in as well.
I was going to ask if you expect anybody else. What do you think, Jeremy Pelzer?
Well, I'm looking at Jesse Bulmert's list of who's considering a run, and there's quite a few people here. Everyone from Frank LaRose to Steve Stivers, several Republican Congress members of Congress, and that's just on the Republican side. On
right.
The Democratic side, you got, you have Tim Ryan, you have Dr. Amy Acton, former Department of Health director. It's starting to narrow down. For a while, it looked like most people in the state of Ohio were going to run for this thing, but there's still quite a few in the running.
It looks like Jane Timken and Josh Mandel are kind of in a heated race for who's going to trump it up the most. Karen Kassler, who's the Trumpiest? Karen, you're on mute.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, so I think part of it is that both of them are trying to carve out that lane. They're both trying to see who can be more of an ally of the former president, because he did win Ohio by 8 points. He won Ohio twice. And even though he lost in 2020, I think that's been part of what they're trying to do here. What I think is interesting, too, is to see how they're both bashing John Kasich,
mm-hmm.
who has still a lot of Republicans are angry with him for not being enough of a supporter of President Trump, for being an actual critic of Trump. And so I think that the pro-Trump, anti-Kasich vibe they're both trying to get out there is really interesting. Does that potentially open up the opportunity for somebody to run against them who would be anti-Trump? I just don't know in this state. I don't know that the Republican Party in this state is going to be supportive of somebody like that. I guess the next couple of months, I think, are really going to be critical, though, with whatever happens with Trump. I mean, now that impeachment's over, the legal system is certainly interested in him. So I guess we'll find out.
Right. Trump took Ohio by a greater margin than he did even in 2016, Jeremy Pelzer. So the calculus isn't illogical.
Pretty straightforward. Hey, mm-hmm. if you hit your wagon to a person who won the state by so much, you have a pretty good chance of winning. Now, the only thing is, like, right now, Trump is still in everyone's mind, and it's, you know, he just left office and he's still a major political figure. I mean, going forward, let's see how big as Obama left office, you know, people were talking about Obama, but then by the midterm elections, you know, it's more about Trump than Obama. So let's see what it happens by the midterm elections and how big a factor that now former President Trump has on the election.
What about fundraising for a primary like this, Jesse Balmer, when you're both kind of, as Kieran put it, trying to carve out the same lane? Do you think that'll be impacted?
I think it'll be a factor, but it's also a pretty wide lane. Jane Timken is pretty prolific in fundraising. She got the Ohio GOP books kind of back in order, and her husband is Tim Timken, the former CEO of Timken Steel, and their family is kind of well-known fundraisers from that Canton area of the state. And then Josh Mandel had millions still in his bank from the last time he ran for office and didn't spend a lot of that money in the years since he dropped out of the race against Sherrod Brown in 2018. And so I think both of them will do just fine on the money side. But obviously, the more money you spend on a primary, the less you have available for a general election.
What's Mandel been doing? We know what Jane Timken's been doing. What's Mandel been doing? Jeremy, do you know?
He got divorced.
Right.
And his court records have been sealed, so we don't know the circumstances of that. The reason he left the race is that he said he wanted to take care of his wife, who had a health condition. And obviously, more recently, he has been preparing to look at a run for U.S. Senate. So he's kind of been out of the public eye ever since he dropped out of the 2018 Senate calculations, and now he's back.
Okay, so on the Democratic side, you mentioned Dr. Amy Acton, probably the most visible, Tim Ryan, U.S. Congressman from Northeast Ohio, and then some people who are not, notably U.S. Representative Joyce Beatty said she won't run. I guess former Columbus Mayor Michael Coleman backed off from intimacies that or suggestions that he might run. He's now fully pulled out of that. Anyone else interested in Kieran Kassler? You're on mute. Sorry.
Can't think of anybody else. I think that's the list, but, you know, as Jeremy was saying, it sure looked like at one point everybody was interested because a Senate seat is a really rare opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to have that open seat where there's no one clear heir apparent is really something that doesn't come along very often. And so anybody who has any sort of political aspirations, especially since, you know, Donald Trump was elected president without any previous political experience, it certainly opens the door for just about anybody.
Now, also open is the top of the chairmanship of the Ohio Republican Party and former state rep John Becker, who has tried to impeach the governor, among other things, has said he's throwing his hat into the ring to replace Jane Timken. Any thoughts about that, Jesse Balmer?
This is just kind of like peak John Becker, I would say. He's a person I've covered for many years now, and he likes to be kind of the contrarian or so forth. He says he wants to give people a choice, and this is certainly
with her to ask her.
Oh, Erin, you're on the air.
This is certainly a choice. The kind of heir apparent to this Ohio GOP seat is Bob Poduchik, who is well known in Ohio Republican politics, going all the way back to Voinovich and Portman, but more recently he ran or had a key role in the Trump campaigns in Ohio. So I asked John Becker if it would be a problem, you know, helping Mike DeWine campaign when he tried to impeach him, or Dave Yost when he said he should resign, and he was like, "Oh no, like that'll be fine." So obviously, this isn't a very serious bid, but it is interesting.
Yeah. Real quick, we've got state lawmakers looking at taking another crack at a bipartisan school funding formula. It passed overwhelmingly in the Ohio House late last year. Kieran, has it been reintroduced now, or are they thinking about something?
Yeah, I mean, it's been reintroduced, and it's something that Speaker Bob Kopp, having been one of the authors of the Patterson bill earlier, says he's very interested in. The question is, of course, where does the money come from? And it looks like the bill that was proposed would take the money that's needed to really bring that school funding formula up to the standard that they're setting here and really get that 60% property taxes, 40% income level in place. They were going to try to take money from other funds, which is how a lot of programs are thinking about getting funding. For instance, the H2 Ohio Clean Lake Erie program was going to plan on doing that. So that's, once again, the real question I think here is how do you fund it? Because the analysis has been that it's going to be about $2 billion more than the state already spends on public education. And that's a tremendous amount of money. And if you're going to do this, you got to commit to doing this. So you got to make a commitment down the road on how you're going to fund it. You got to come up with a funding source.
Okay, so what are stakeholders saying about this? Jesse Ballmer?
Well, I think you're seeing a lot of support for the concept. Like, it's something that both Republicans and Democrats can get behind. It's something that passed the House pretty easily last year. But, you know, Karen hits the nail on the head there. It's the money. This isn't something that Mike DeWine included in his executive budget, kind of knowing that we were going to have a debate about the school funding formula later down the line. And as everyone may or may not remember, we needed to pass a balanced budget by the end of June. So we'll
see.
There'll be months of debate on this topic.
After months, years of debate on it now. Decades of debate on it now. Hey, Jeremy, what about the governor's re-up on gun reform with provisions tucked into the state budget bill language?
Sure. DeWine, ever since the 2019 Dayton mass shooting, has been trying to get, he doesn't like to call it gun control. He likes to call it just like gun reforms, gun law reforms. And this is the latest attempt for him to get state lawmakers to pass it. And it's gotten a very cool reception at the very least by the legislature. And so now he's trying to put some of these reforms into his budget. These are not, I don't know if you'd even, these are a lot of voluntary things. These are not, this is not, it's not like a red flag law. It's not a mandatory background check. It's things that are a lot more softer than that.
Like Jesse Ballmer, any chance this stuff will slip through?
It certainly has a better chance than some of those more controversial items that Jeremy was talking about. This is things like increasing penalties for those who give guns to people who are not allowed to have them, whether because of a prior conviction or because they're children or something like that. So even things like kind of the fix-nicks, so making sure there are fewer loopholes where people who are banned from having guns can obtain them, are part of it. Those are principles that even the NRA and gun groups have gotten, are saying, yeah, we should keep people who shouldn't have guns from having guns. So this is the lowest hanging fruit, but that doesn't mean it will pass.
Okay, exactly, because it is what it is. Well, we just have about a minute left, and I'm wondering, I'm afraid to ask, what are you guys looking toward this week for news? Karen Kassler?
Actually, I'm off starting tomorrow. So I'm actually looking forward to a little bit of a break because it's been, you know, news from a fire hose for the last couple last year. So, yeah.
God, no kidding. How about you, Jeremy Pelzer?
I think, it's going to be a lot more of the same stories that we've been following, you know, the rollout of vaccines, lawmakers trying to push the same agenda that they've been trying to push, and, you know, just another week of it.
Yeah, another week of it. You too, Jesse Ballmer?
Yeah, at the end of the week, the Ohio GOP is going to pick their next leader, so that should be fun, and we'll see if John Becker has a shot.
Okay. Jesse Balmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Thanks for your time today. I always appreciate it.
Yep, always fun. Good time.
Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Same to you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
And Karen Kassler, bureau chief for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. You take it easy now, Karen.
I'll do my best. Thanks.
Okay. And thanks, everybody else, for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.